You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. We are joined today by Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who after graduating from college in ROTC in 1981 was commissioned a second lieutenant in military intelligence. His first assignment was as a paratrooper for the 82nd Airborne Division. Since then, he served in a variety of command and staff positions to include the commander of the 313th Military Intelligence Battalion and G2 of the 82nd Airborne Division, also G2 of the 18th Airborne Corps, the CJ2 of the Combined Joint Task Force 180 Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, the commander of the 111th Military Intelligence Brigade at the Army's Intelligence Center, the Director of Intelligence, Joint Special Operations Command with duty in Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, the Director of Intelligence, the United States Central Command with duty in OEF and OIF, the Director of Intelligence for the Joint Staff, the Director of Intelligence for the International Security Assistant Force Afghanistan and U.S. Forces Afghanistan, and Special Assistant to the Deputy Chief of Staff G2. He most recently served as Assistant Director of National Intelligence for Partner Engagement before becoming the 18th Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency in July of 2012. He served as the DIA director until his retirement from the military in autumn of 2014. Thank you, General Flynn, for taking the time
to
talk to
us. Thanks, I really appreciate it. It's like reading my obituary.
Well, not yet. We're going to add several paragraphs to that. So I want to start broadly and kind of tighten up the specific issues as we go. And one of the reasons I was really excited to have you was that since you began your career in military intelligence in the early 80s, you've really seen military intelligence transition from the Soviet Union as a main adversary to asymmetrical threats in the 90s to things like coin theory, and then finally now back to great power adversaries, not called enemies, but adversaries. So can you talk very broadly about how the mission changed while you were in military intelligence from the 80s through a couple years ago?
Well, I came into, as you highlighted in my biography, I came in at the beginning of an era, I think, where it was the fall, it was the beginning of the fall or the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, and at that time, of course, none of us knew that. So we trained for big conventional military operations, big force-on-force operations, and our doctrine was written that way. The challenge, though, in the 80s, was that we came out of the Vietnam War, and we acted as though we were never going to fight that kind of war again. And so, actually, my early days in, which was in the 82nd Airborne Division, and then my initial days as an instructor, I was actually involved in quite a bit of what we would call then low-intensity conflict operations with the 82nd in Central America. And then teaching those kinds of things. So what was interesting for me was, even though our military was still looking at these large-scale operations and training for these large-scale operations, and our doctrine was like that, I began to see a transition as a young officer that we were going back into something. There was these challenges around the world, these proxy wars. And then all of a sudden you jump into the 90s. So you had the fall of the Soviet Union, then you jump into the 90s and you had the big Desert Shield, Desert Storm, conventional force on force, and we all felt really good about it. but it was really a tactical engagement. It was 100 hours of war. You know, it took us 6 months to kind of get prepared. We did it. It was over in a very short period of time, and we were out of there. And we, you know, we felt good about, you know, running, you know, over the really a fourth-rate military at the time. You know, and it's that's good. I mean, we were prepared to do that, and not going to take anything away from how that was done. But then, again, we were always sort of looking for that kind of a war to a degree. I mean, in our doctrines, we were training, we were writing about it, but the world was pulling us in a different direction.
Right.
And we suddenly found ourselves in the Balkans. You know, so the 90s was, and we're still there. I mean, we still have, you know, some
number
in the
Balkans. The Balkans.
Yeah, so we're now all of a sudden, we're now a decade into the Balkans in a very heavy way with Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kosovo. I mean, all of the challenges there, and that was actually a religious, you know, that was a, you know, it was a lot of, you know, the Croatians, there was a lot of Christians and Muslims killing each other, and a lot of brutality, and it was still a result to a degree of the second or third order effect of the breakup of the Soviet Union, because it was Yugoslavia. So we had this problem going on. And now all of a sudden you jump into this last decade, the first decade of the 21st century, where we had the attack, you know, on 9/11. And we saw some indicators of that with other attacks in the late 90s, you know, the tower attacks in New York where the van blew up, and it was a lot of people. It was some number that were killed, and there was some number that certainly that was asphyxiated then. But so now you had the last 10 years, we had bin Laden attacks, you know, the United States of America in a big way, and now we're facing this new, relatively new threat of radical Islamic extremism. Mm-hmm. And it's still ongoing today, and the problem has grown far, far worse. All those transitions, all those different things, and that's very, very strategic, because there was a lot of other little things that were happening around the world, you know, not to mention what was going on out in the Pacific theater with North Korea and China. But we never caught up with ourselves. Our doctrine, our weapons, our training, you know, the agility of the intelligence community. And so thank God we had good military forces. We had very, very innovative, you know, young people that were part of our intelligence community that would, despite the bureaucracy, would still do a really decent job to try to help us solve some of these really complex problems, 80s, 90s, and this last decade. So, you know, what I would tell you is that now as I look at what's next, you know, what's the next transition? And the next transition, nobody will predict. Nobody will get it right. Nobody. I don't care how much we're, you know, how good our intelligence community or system is. We won't get it right. There are things that keep me up at night. And I think that the advent of technology in a much bigger way, in social media in a much bigger way, interacting with human behavior is actually causing something that we are starting to sense, but we don't totally understand, and what might it cause, and it could cause some really extraordinary conflicts.
Right.
You know, I mean, you've got a situation in Europe right now. I've just seen two statements from two different chiefs of defense basically talking about, you know, the immigrant situation in a way. In fact, one of them, I think it was either Sweden or Norway. People can say what they want about those two countries, but these are very thoughtful guys.
Yep.
Said that, wait, we're about to walk into World War III here. And so the bigger question is, are we ready for these transitions? Do we transition well? And both my answer to both of those are no and no. You know, and one one example is in this war against, you know, the war on terror, okay, this insurgent war that we were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last, that we're still involved in, the doctrine that we started that war with on 9/11 had to be rewritten in 2006, the counterinsurgency manual, right? So the counterinsurgency manual was rewritten. But we were fighting. We had already been there for almost 5 years. So what the hell were we using?
Right.
You know, what were we using? We're using some old manuals, some old doctrine, some old equipment.
A lot of making it up as
a lot
we
of
went
making
along.
It up as we were going. And all of a sudden, 5 years into the war, somebody finally said, you know what, maybe we got it wrong. Maybe we got our doctrine wrong. So we had to rewrite it. Well, when you rewrite a new manual, that doesn't mean that everybody reads it. Now you got to train it.
Right.
And that doesn't take – you can't do that overnight. And so anyway, I also think that we have forgotten how to win wars. I really, really believe that we have forgotten how to win wars, and we participate in them.
Well, I mean, we haven't had a clean win since 1945, right. Probably. Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of muddling through, and yeah. You know, Desert Storm perhaps was a clean win.
I'll tell you, I get tired of those generals, frankly, and leaders who I've heard say, we've never lost a battle, you know, we've never lost a fight on the battlefield, you know, we win every one of them. Well, okay, so I got it. So our tactical capability right. is exquisite. You know, the intelligence system that provides us targeting is so good today, and it's machine-like, particularly in our special operations world. And I will tell you, they've brought it to a state of art. But our problem is winning those tactical engagements doesn't matter. Right. It actually has not allowed us to win the war. We have not won the war. First, we haven't defined it as a war.
Right.
You know. So, you know, the intelligence community and the intelligence system and the leaders inside the intelligence system, you know, the old adage, truth to power, truth to power. Once the intelligence system loses that sort of nom de guerre of itself, then I think we're in trouble. I think our country's in trouble. And I have seen that begin to tilt again. When I saw it, I studied it, of what we essentially lied about in Vietnam, and then some other examples between the time in Vietnam and then I think what I see now, and what I've seen, you know, in some cases. So we're in a difficult spot right now. We have forgotten how to win wars, and we need to remind ourselves, what does it take to win?
You brought up technology, and I want to talk a little bit about that, because I think a big part of military intelligence is understanding the capabilities of our adversaries. It's mm-hmm. the technological capabilities
yep.
our adversaries. And you brought up Desert Storm also, and I think that's to me, a very interesting war, because I'm wondering from your perspective, since you were on both sides of it and within the intelligence community, was it a surprise that what was vaunted as the fifth largest army in the world, a battle-tested professional army using modern Soviet yeah. equipment that we yeah. had been very afraid of in the 1980s, staring across the Fulda Gap in Germany. Did you have you and the military intelligence community have a little bit of hindsight soul-searching about what you thought about the Soviet threat in the 1980s based on what happened in Desert Storm
yeah.
with our equipment and their equipment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things about intelligence analysis is worst-casing it. So you'll worst-case it. And you know, because if you worst-case it and it turns out that way, you're a hero. If you worst-case it and it doesn't, and you defeat the adversary, then, you know, you allowed the commander to prepare for the worst case, and he was ready, mm-hmm. right? The challenge is that, you know, you give somebody, you put a tanker into a T-72, doesn't mean that he's trained to right. operate that thing very well. So one of the things of the intelligence community, particularly the defense intelligence community, is to analyze the capabilities of not just the weapon system. You know, a rifle is a rifle is a rifle, you know, fires a bullet in this direction, this fast, goes this far, you know, whether you put it in your hands, Vince, or my hands. But now, what's the quality of the individual shooting it?
Right.
What's the quality of their discipline? What's the quality of their resilience? What's the quality of their morale? All those components, because, you know, can they withstand, you know, pressure? So do they train in an environment that at least replicates or tries to replicate the pressure that you might have, you know, on a battlefield? And we knew all these things about some of these enemies that we're facing. Now, you know, to kind of bring it to what we are, where we are today, mm-hmm. we're not facing a very sophisticated enemy. They don't have sophisticated capabilities. They got, you know, some shoulder fired stuff. They've got some rifles. They've got, you know, they've got some capabilities to, they use some technology, phones and stuff to build bombs. They're using, you know, ammonium nitrate as an example that's used for fertilizer to build some of these bombs mm-hmm. that are flipping over, you know, several ton vehicles on the battlefield. So it's ingenious the way our enemies actually think about how to be cunning, you know, and how to
right.
operate against us. So So we have some challenges, and we've had challenges, and I think that if everybody's, you know, happy that we went through the Iraqi army like a hot knife through butter, I mean, we should be, we should not be surprised, and we should, had it been any more difficult, we should be upset at ourselves. Right. We should be irritated with how much money we put into our ability and our capability and our readiness and our training and our intelligence system to be able to know that. I mean, you know, we put a lot of money into our intelligence system, but it's never predicted the sort of the event.
Right.
We've always then have to react to it, like law enforcement. You know, the crime occurs, and then the cops
right.
show
There's
up.
No pre-crime.
Yeah, the cops show up, and they do the forensics, and now they gotta find the criminal, right? And there's a, you know, what we want to do is we want to be preventative. We want our intelligence system to be preventative. We want it to prevent, and we want it to understand better. We want it to know things that are differently. And there's a lot more to know these days because of just, frankly, the sheer volume of data available to us in the intelligence community. So there's another transition. You asked about transitions earlier, Ben. That's a great question. We're in another transition right now where the intelligence community is lethargic and not agile. Not the people necessarily. A lot of the analysts that I've worked with, a lot of the junior leaders I've worked with, but there's a cultural lethargy in the intelligence community, a cultural bureaucracy that resists change. And that resistance of change, it actually does hurt our country. Mm-hmm. And so the leaders at the top level, they've got to back each other up, and they've got to see the next horizon for what it is and prepare for that next horizon. And I think that what happens is the cultural lethargy, the lack of agility inside of these organizations, because frankly some of them have gotten too big. Mm-hmm. They've gotten too arrogant in their ways, and they've lost sight of what they're really good at, what their core capabilities are supposed to be. And when that happens, and it has happened, we're setting ourselves up for another failure. Now, hopefully, we are big enough and strong enough of a country to withstand another body blow.
Right.
I hope that body blow isn't a weapon of mass destruction, you know, in a New York City or a Washington, D.C. that kills 200,000 right. instead of, you know, 3,000, right?
Right, absolutely. One thing that has really made you stand out is how much of a vocal opponent to regime change you've been. And it's not just about Iraq. You came straight out and said Iraq was a mistake. Your quote is, "History will not be and should not be kind with the decision." But also places like Libya. But beyond what made it think, look, I thought it was interesting, beyond these states, you've also been a vocal opponent of, for lack of a better term, regime change within non-state organizations. Mm-hmm. People, you know, Zarqawi, Zawahiri, Bin Laden. And that brings up the question about Syria today, about the argument about taking Assad out of power, and the mm-hmm. argument about using drone attacks against people like Anwar al-Awlaki, who, after Bin Laden was killed, yeah. was considered the most dangerous man in the world. Can you talk a little bit about that philosophy, about, you know, the decapitation? That's a fancy way that the military's talked about ways to win
it's
wars.
It's a failed strategy.
That
strategy is a failed strategy. That actually comes from the previous administration to the Obama administration. But that's a failed strategy. You know, you can kill these leaders all day long. Look, I mean, look at what we've done. This is we're getting ready to roll into the fifth anniversary of the death of Bin Laden, right? What has that gotten us? That's right. gotten us almost a tripling, if not quadrupling in some places, of the scale of this enemy that we're facing, and to include right here in the homeland. So the and I don't even want to use the word, but the taking out of leaders of this current enemy that we're facing, that's a failed strategy. What we should do, it doesn't mean that we don't go after them. Mm-hmm. I would much rather capture these guys, put them in a military tribunal, show them for what they are, which is really weak-kneed individuals who have nothing but excuses. And actually, when you capture some of these guys, some of them show their true colors, and they're not as big and bold as they are when they're on the battlefield and spewing all this hatred. So So it's not that I'm against regime change in non-state. It's just that we have to be smarter about what we do. And I mean, Alaki, why didn't we, if we could have captured him, why not capture a guy like that? Right. If we could have captured bin Laden, I know it would have been a circus in some courtroom, but you know what? Make it a circus, but it's, you're showing this guy for who he is, and you're getting him to admit that either one, this is about a religion, or two, I just, you know, I'm just a hateful person, and like I'm like another Hitler,
right,
kind of thing, you know, like I'm sort of like that ism was, because like I've said, you know, if we had lost to Hitler in World War II, we'd be praying at the altar of Nazism. So, and, you know, we don't want to pray to the altar of radical Islamism. We just don't. So we have to understand what's happening. So let's just use Libya, because you mentioned Libya. You know, I mean, we went into Iraq, and we did what we did in Iraq, and look at what we got. And then all of a sudden, did we learn a lesson by looking at Iraq and then going into Libya? I mean, Libya, just the other day, our Secretary of Defense, our current Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, is now talking about, you know, putting troops into Libya, more special force into Libya. Why? Because Libya is a failed state. So we went into Libya, God knows why, I guess to get rid of Gaddafi. We had nobody, you know, behind him to put in behind him. I mean, it was sort of like a political decision to get rid of him. A guy who was actually had given up his nuclear program for us, who was taking Al-Qaeda prisoners who we were capturing, and he was taking them back into his country and putting them into prison. So when Gaddafi was killed, essentially, and overthrown, now Libya is a failed state. And you've got elements of Al-Qaeda and elements of the Islamic State now widening the problem inside of Libya. Libya is going to be basically a bastion for a safe haven, if you will, for even more growth of this radical element that we are facing. And frankly, one of the sad things about Libya is that's where most of the migrants. So if you look at the migrant routes coming across the Mediterranean, one of the major routes is coming out of Libya, going right into Italy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's thousands and thousands of people a month. I mean, there's so many problems that were created by Libya. You know, so you can look back at the problem in Iraq and the decision made for Iraq, which I do believe history will not be kind to that decision. Now, all of a sudden, this administration does it for Libya.
Right.
With no plan for what we were going to do next. And it's like, come on.
And I think one of the points that you've made very, very strongly was the lack of knowledge of next guy up. You know, we can eliminate one leader, but the person behind may be much worse. And if we might be better off with the person that we know versus the one that we have no idea what direction that's going to go in. You brought up special operations tactics, and I want to ask you about that, because JSOC and others were part of was really one of the broadest parts now of the war on terror. There's less about
it's one of, when you back to transitions. Mm-hmm. That machine that was built was probably one of the single biggest transitions for the intelligence community in the intelligence community's history.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, so please.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, it's you know, and I'll tell you, I really credit this to Stan McChrystal, the commander for 5 years, 5 years straight of Joint Special Operations Command, you know, to drive this transformation. It was a transformation of not only how special operations were, you know, would have to operate on this new battlefield, but how the intelligence system needed to enable that operational element and that operational arm. And there was enormous resistance. National Security Agency, Central Intelligence Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, National Geospatial Agency, the sort of the, you know, the big ones, they all resisted it, because it was like, well, you know, the war is going to be over next, you know, the next rotation and the next rotation and the next rotation, and they all felt that way. And to a degree, they still do, and it's not to disparage the people that were coming out of those organizations that were being told go out, you know, and serve. It's really, again, it's back to this in some ways, a cultural arrogance that's like, well, that's not really our job. So this transformation that was put in place, it began with tactics. Tactically, we had to do things differently. We had to, and we were on a battlefield where people were losing their lives, and frankly, we were losing. We were losing that war. And so we had to do things differently, completely differently. And, you know, and there's been a lot written about it and stuff, so I won't get into all the machinations about it, but it was a significant transformation to integrate all of the intelligence capabilities, some that you never even heard about. You know, most people never even heard about NMEC, which is an acronym for the National Media Exploitation Center. You know, it's kind of like, what do they do? Mm-hmm. That, you know, the building that they're in out in Tyson's Corner, out in that part, you know, they used to call it the toilet bowl because of the way it looked. I mean, how disparaging is that?
Right.
For a bunch of people who actually, the people that work in that organization, they're saviors. They saved us many, many ways over by raising their hand and saying, you know what, we can help. So this is an intelligence capability, and the leadership there said, hey, we think we can help. And so they reached out because everybody else was all more SIGINT, more human, you know, more imagery, which was all necessary, and it was bringing it together. But every intelligence component, they want to get credit for their intelligence, that SIGINT was the one that got them.
Right.
You know, geospatial or imagery was the one that got them. It was the human that got them. I mean, everybody wants that credit. And I don't know how many times I've seen different briefings about Zarqawi as an example that, you know, people, organizations taking credit for getting them instead of saying this was a massive team effort built over a period of about 3 years to get to that level. And you know, people can take credit for what they want, but the credit goes to the operators on the battlefield that suddenly realized how important intelligence was to them, and they began to pull the system forward. They are the ones that really, I think, to, you know, if you're looking at not only the physical bravery and the courage and the resilience that they demonstrated over time, but what they did was they forced success by being successful, mm-hmm. and they forced integration on the battlefield, because all of a sudden, you know, we were in the summer of 2004, we were doing maybe 4 to 7 raids a month. And everybody's kind of like, well, you know, and we were asking for more. We wanted more stuff. We wanted more intelligence capabilities. It's like, well, you know, I'm not sure if we can afford it. You know, we're busy over here. We're busy over there. We got problems everywhere around the world. We're at war. Our nation decided to take us to war.
Right.
The president of the United States decided to take us to war. And we got people back in Washington, D.C., where we're sitting right now, just kind of going, well, you know, yeah, I got it. You're not really the priority right now. I mean, I physically flew back to Washington, D.C. as a colonel and walked the halls of the Pentagon to just raise hell with people, because it was like, are you kidding me? I just found out from your office that you guys denied this request. You have every capability to be able to provide it, and you denied it. Why? Well, you guys just aren't the priority. I said, go take that over to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Tell the president that it's not the priority, because I was just told that it is the priority. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting fired up here with you. But
you know, it seems like a lot of what you're saying is that the word community and intelligence community is not being embraced. The idea of...
Yeah, it wasn't at that time.
Okay.
It wasn't at that time. I think that it has progressively gotten better in certain areas, but we have to make sure that we don't lose sight of that. We don't lose sight of what that means. It's not about, you know, sitting around in Washington, D.C. and a bunch of us, you know, staring at our navels in some meeting that we have where all the IC members are together. You know, it's now, you know, literally where the phrase where the rubber meets the road on the battlefield, where we're placing men and women of our intelligence community, of our military forces on the battlefield where their lives are at stake, and they're not there because they want to be there. They're there because they're directed to be there. That community better be all capital letters. That word community better be in all mm-hmm. capital letters on the battlefield. And I'm telling you, I'm sitting here today, and I have been in contact with guys on the battlefield in Iraq today who don't believe that.
Right.
And so that's a problem. That's a problem for me, because I'm like, Jesus, what's going on? Why isn't the message getting up to the highest level? Or why isn't the highest level, you know, paying attention to what's happening? What more do you need? And all this other stuff. I know we got other priorities, but you know, when we win, we can have all the arguments we want. If we lose, we're not going to be arguing. We're going to be told what to do.
In January of 2010, you wrote a paper that was for the Center on New American Security called mm-hmm. Fixing Intel, a Blueprint for Making Intelligence Relevant in Afghanistan. And I wanted to kind of pull, I'm going to read a little bit of it, kind of the first chunk after the abstract, because I want to ask you about this. This is pretty scathing. You wrote, 8 years into the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. intelligence community is only marginally relevant to the overall strategy. Having focused the overwhelming majority of its collection efforts and analytical brain power on insurgent groups, the vast intelligence apparatus is unable to answer fundamental questions about the environment in which U.S. and allied forces operate and the people they seek to persuade. Ignorant of local economics and landowners, hazy about who the power brokers are and how they might be influenced, incurious about the correlations between various development projects and the levels of cooperation among villagers, and disengaged from people in the best positions of financiers, whether aid workers or Afghan soldiers, U.S. intelligence officers and analysts can do little but shrug in response to high-level decision-makers seeking the knowledge, analysis, and information they need to wage a successful counterinsurgency. Has it gotten any better?
Yeah, no. I mean, okay. How can it be? I mean, no. So I appreciate you you recognizing that article, and that was, you know, along with Matt Pottinger and Paul Batchelor, two really courageous guys that, you know, that were willing to create this this argument. That's essentially what that is. You know, fixing intelligence in the blueprint for, you know, intelligence, you know, in Afghanistan, you could put it for, you know, in San Bernardino, California. You could put it for, you know, Syria. You could put it for Libya, Nigeria. You could put anything in there. Because the point is, we fail to understand the operational environment that we are operating within. And when you fail to understand that operational environment, you do not apply the right mix of capabilities and resources to essentially achieve your objectives. And that failure still exists today. We are matching the wrong set of resources against the problem, because we look at it like, well, these guys, you know, I mean, you know, the big debate about clearly defining the enemy. You can't defeat an enemy that you won't clearly define, period. Don't clearly define the enemy, you can't defeat them, because you can't understand what their weaknesses, strengths are, vulnerabilities, you know, all that sort of stuff. So so that what you just read was a recognition that we were in a country and we were fighting an enemy, but the enemy, and we were trying to protect the population and instill confidence in not only the population of Afghanistan, but also the confidence of the International Security Assistance Forces, which at that time I think there was 43 countries. Mm-hmm. You know, we ended up with about 49. So the entire dynamic of the battlefield, and we were so overly focused on capturing and killing. Now, where did I come from? In terms of a big chunk of my time in the war, was the capture and kill community.
Right.
So we, like we just talked about, we created a machine-like capability. So I, you know, that was my mission at that time. My mission now was to look at the whole problem and go, okay, you know, what's going on here? Because we weren't winning, and so, but we were killing and capturing, no problem, but we weren't winning. And the problem, the scale of the enemy was growing. You know, it's the Muj math, right? Kill one, create 10. I mean, that's a pretty real math problem.
And as a historian, that's straight out of Vietnam.
It's not that in our doctrine we didn't have the requirement to understand military geography. So military geography and doctrine is not just mountains and roads and rivers. It's also the human terrain. So it's not like we didn't have this, you know, in our doctrine. We just didn't care about it. Honestly, we didn't really do it sufficient justice. And so whose job is that? Is that the intelligence community's job? The only community that we have in the United States of America that can, you know, collect, analyze, produce, and disseminate knowledge as good as any other organization in the world is the United States intelligence community. That's a strategic advantage that we have if we use it properly, if we focus it properly. So we had really good knowledge about the Taliban. We had really good knowledge about the Haqqani network. We had really good knowledge about Al-Qaeda and what they were doing. But when we're looking around, as I'm looking around the battlefield, I'm going, geez, we don't even know who the district governors are. We don't know who the provincial governors are. We don't know who these guys, the ministers are. We don't know the chiefs of police. We don't know the district chiefs of police. Where did these guys come from? We're dealing with them. We had no clue about how much corruption was going on. Now, some people probably did that. You know, the CIGAR, the IG of Afghanistan Reconstruction, the CIGAR office that stood up, and I don't know the exact total name of that acronym, but it goes by CIGAR. I mean, just look at some of their assessments coming out of Afghanistan in terms of corruption. Now, that's part of our problem. We're to blame for a lot of that. Oh. So that's an understanding of all of this. So who's responsible to do that? Is it some civil affairs unit out of Fort Bragg, or is it the intelligence community? I think it's the intelligence community. And actually, that phrase that you read was probably being polite.
Well, there's an extraordinary phrase also in that paper where you say the U.S. intelligence community has fallen into the trap of waging an anti-insurgency campaign rather than a counter-insurgency campaign.
Yeah.
And that sounds like what you're talking about here, the idea of just kill them all instead of understanding what's causing the insurgency
in
the first
place. Capture, kill, and then what do you do? I mean, so how do you fix the problem? If you only look at this as a military problem, then you're only going to get a particular hammer based on based on the nail that you're looking at. And if you want a military solution, you pick this hammer up. The challenge for the country in what we're facing, and for the intelligence system and the intelligence community, is to help our leadership understand what it is that we're facing and understand the full breadth of the problem. And it's not just this particular hammer, because there's even the administration right now, they appear, even though they talk a little bit about some of these other things, and this goes over the last couple of administrations. I mean, there's some things there. And again, I'm a guy that was involved in it, and I'm arguing these points in uniform, and I'm trying to stress, things that we need to be thinking about, the ideology versus just the fact that this guy's a member of the Taliban, mm-hmm. right? What's the ideology that's driving him? That's not a military solution.
Right.
That's a completely different issue. But we tend to use the military as the only tool in our toolkit. And, there's some diplomatic stuff here. There's some nicety, what I call the political baloney, that goes on. And frankly, there's an old phrase, what's said in the room is not what's said outside the room. And what that means is that, you have all this glad-handing, nice talk, and outside, what you want in the room is you want real blunt,
right,
honest conversation, and then what you want said outside the room, you want that same honesty. We don't get that.
Right.
We don't get that. I think our military guys typically do it. I think our intelligence community, I mean, if you were to ask, analysts what they truly believe, if they didn't feel unencumbered to speak about how they really felt, I think that they'd really, they'd be really frustrated.
And you brought it up to the modern day, so I want to ask you about ISIS, because that is the main threat that we're looking at overseas. And I assume the answer to this, but I'll ask you anyway, can we continue business as usual? Do we need ground forces? Do we need a change in doctrine? Can change be politically possible? Because, of course, Clausewitzian theory says we can only say what we want, but politics is going to be the key component here. Can we get the votes to do a change in our tactics and strategy against ISIS? And you've written that finance is the Achilles heel for ISIS. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the financial and their entire, you have to understand their entire network and what makes them thrive. Certainly financial system is a big part of that. And we can't allow, when you get into the gray world of threat financing, and you start to really dig down into the forensics of a particular financial network for a terrorist group, you might find people on the other end of that seem like they're legitimate. Banks,
right?
National leaders, and even in our own system, even in our own country. So are they witting to this financial network, or are they unwitting? If they're unwitting, then you need to tell them. if they're winning, you need to arrest them. You need to stop their behavior. So financial component of the funding, but you can't just shut that down. That's a tactic.
Right.
Just like going and killing Baghdadi. Hey, Baghdadi could be dead today. I don't know. All I know is that I haven't heard from him lately, and maybe he's dead. They seem to be operating just fine without him being out there exposed too much. So the tactic of killing the enemy, capturing the enemy, stopping their financial network, doing some information operations to counter these beautiful magazines that the Islamic State puts out. I mean, just unbelievable. It's high quality.
Right.
The amount of jihadists who have thousands, tens of thousands of Twitter followers, the influence that they're doing. Those are tactics to go after them. We have to look at the whole problem, and we have to recognize that the ideology that we're facing, this religious ideology of radical Islamism, is actually the bigger problem. And so is that, is this a Christian versus Islamic war? No, it's not. It's Western values against a violent, barbaric interpretation of Islam. And the rest of the Arab world is sort of the legitimate Arab world, and I don't use that word loosely. I mean, there are legitimate Arabs out there, leaders in countries that know that there's a problem. They have to do more. They have to take this on. They have to take this problem on. But we've got to have this conversation very honestly. Without it, we're never going to achieve we're never going to get past this, and we're going to be in this perpetual state of conflict, and we're going to grow even more tension in our own country. Honestly, again, I'm paying very close attention to what's happening in Europe right now with this immigration problem,
right.
And they're having significant problems. I mean, to the point of you're going to see levels of violence, I think, in Europe directed against some of these immigrants just because of their behavior. And that second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth order effect of all this could turn into, I think it was either the Swedish or the Norwegian chief of defense that said, World War III.
Right. So a couple more questions, and then we can go from here. But I want to switch gears pretty dramatically and ask you about potential great power conflicts.
Yeah.
Conflicts is the wrong word. The idea of adversaries who are not terrorist organizations, who are other very capable militaries.
Sure, Russia,
like
China.
Russia, China.
Yep.
The potential of India, Pakistan going bad. How do we refocus attention? Do we need to refocus attention? Can we do both at the same time?
Yeah.
Do we have the intelligence capabilities to pay attention to the changing dynamic in the asymmetrical threats, like you talked about, the idea of identifying the problem, of getting the intelligence community to work together as a community, while at the same time paying attention to the great power conflict potentials with the Chinese in the South China Sea and the Russians in Ukraine and Crimea?
Yeah.
How do we do both? Can we do both? And are we taking our eye off the ball when you see things like the OPM hacks and Russia's actions in Ukraine and Putin's resurgency?
So, your listeners too, don't ever don't fail to understand tactics and strategy, and then what I would call sort of grand strategy or geopolitical dynamics of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you really the best way to understand it, what you're asking, because it's a very real problem. I mean, yeah, so the answer is yes, I'll try to answer every part of what you're asked, but you really have to understand economics. You have to understand the global economy, and I'm not a subject matter expert in this specific issue, but I've studied it. I have a little bit of I've studied enough economics, and I've studied enough of what these countries do, Russia and China, and their economies, European economies, commercial markets. And the ability to move commerce around the world, where are investments by China, by Russia, going elsewhere other than in their own countries? So where else are they investing around the world? What are they investing in? What are the types of commodities that they're investing in? And sometimes even that can be a tactical issue, because you might say, okay, well, China's investing in a certain type of rare earth element in Africa. Okay, fine. But where are they investing and why? It's not so much to get that particular commodity. It may be because they want to develop a political alliance with that country. And it may be that in the last 10 or 20 years, the U.S. actually had a stronger alliance with that country. So China's using their economic strength to be able to drive a wedge in alliances that the U.S. had with other countries.
Right.
So economics is a big, big part of warfare, and it's what drives us to these larger conventional force-on-force, state-on-state wars. Because when one country feels like there's a problem and they feel like their economic system, you know, if Russia feels like it's going to collapse, Russia's going to act differently. If China felt like it was going to collapse, it would act differently. So when you look at China, let's just take China. Mm-hmm. China has a, you know, we look at 4 years, one administration to the next. They got to go back through a political election. We're going through a national election right now. Everybody's saying all kinds of things. Most of them are talking about the Islamic State. But when we look at China's timeline, China's time horizons, you know, 4 years to them is nothing.
Right.
They look at a generation, which is about 30 or 50 years. So China believes that by maybe 2025, maybe certainly by 2050, that China will be the dominant world power. They will be the they will be the leader on the world stage, and everybody will be kowtowing to China by 2050. So how do you get there? And you know, how do you build yourself up to do that? If you look back in just 2000, not that long ago, so half of a generation ago, right, 15 years ago, what was China doing on the continent of Africa? And, you know, rhetoric question, but essentially about a year ago, they weren't doing much. They were there. So big answer is not much. They were doing some investment here and there. You look, fast forward almost 15 years, and I think it was the year 2014, China invested like $200 billion on the continent of Africa. Why? And in what? And for what reasons? All the things that I just talked mm-hmm. about. And so why? And now China is also, you know, when you think about the Africa Union out of Ethiopia, which is where they're based, the Chinese are right there working with them.
Right.
Okay, they're part of it. It's almost like they're part of it. The Chinese got involved in counter-piracy off the coast of Somalia back around roughly 2007, 2008 timeframe. Did they join the coalition task force that was there? No. They came in there all by themselves. They said, we're here. We're going to operate. Give us a block of water that we can operate in. And they operated there. So was it to counter pirates? No. What was it really meant to do? Well, what it did for them. So now we're, let's just say it was 2008. This is 2015. So 7 years later, the Chinese Navy now has been transiting, you know, the Straits of Malacca and the other straits in the South China Sea out underneath the, you know, south of India mm-hmm. into the Arabian Sea. And now they're operating with their Navy in a much different way. And that's 7 years into it. So now you project, you know, maybe three more years. So that's a decade. And you project another 20 years. So they have a very, you know, the madness to their method.
Right.
It's pretty thoughtful. It's long term. And you have to look at all these dimensions. It's economic at the very end of the day. So what will cause us to go sort of force on force? And I'm glad you mentioned India, Pakistan. Okay. So India is it's an awesome country. It's very powerful, big country. They will surpass China in population between now and 2050. If I worry about a conventional war, I worry about that.
Yeah.
And I worry about that because the best friend of Pakistan is China since about 1957. Never broken up their relationship. They've always helped them. They're right there with them. You know, we've had a mixed,
right, we've been all over the place.
Mixed relationship with, yeah, with Pakistan. You know, who's the best friend of India? India. India is the best friend of India. You know, there's mixed relationships because we do different things with them. And the Indians still get a lot of their weaponry from Russia. So, but if those two countries went to war, both of them are nuclear.
Right.
One is far larger than the other. You know, you're talking about 1.2 billion people versus about 185 million people, you know, in Pakistan. Larger military, larger capabilities in India. Very, actually not bad. They're pretty good, pretty effective, well-trained. Pakistan got a lot of, They got a lot of they're in a tough spot right now because they've had to fight a lot. They've been fighting in their own inside their own country. Right. Extraordinary courage by the Pakistani military. Extraordinary courage. I mean, they have had a lot of their own casualties. So they're in a kind of a little bit of a weakened position. So they're you know could a terrorist group that has been allowed to reside and not pressured enough inside of Pakistan, like Lashkar-e-Taiba, go do another Mumbai attack or in a bigger way? I mean, an Indian Air Force base, I believe, was just attacked, mm-hmm. you know, within the past month by one of these radicalized elements. They actually got inside the base. But if you had something bigger from the other side of the border, from Pakistan's side of the border into India, you know, I was glad to see the Indians, the way that they responded when Mumbai occurred. They took a deep breath. They looked at the strategic picture, and they said, okay, we're going to resolve this, but this is not good.
Well, yeah, and these are two countries that have fought three wars against each other, you know, including the only war between two nuclear states in 1999. Yeah.
But this has changed, though. The dynamic has changed because the scale of radical Islamist groups known and designated by our own U.S. State Department in Pakistan has at least doubled. Actually, it might be a little bit more than that. Doubled in the last 10 years. So you have these groups in Pakistan that you know that could be used in different ways against India, or they might decide themselves to cause tension. They don't care that their idea about living and dying is totally different than what we believe. So I think this notion of conventional war is very real. Everybody's worried about destroying ISIS. We need to do that. We have to do that. Can we juggle more than one ball? And the answer is yeah. In fact, we don't have a choice.
Right.
We have to. So we have to figure out how do we juggle. How does the United States intelligence community enable this country to understand the world in a way that's far deeper? And frankly, if you only relied on intelligence, we're going to fail as a nation. But the intelligence community has a big role in that, big role in that. And I think that there's got to be some different ways that the intelligence community functions and operates and allows its people to operate in a much freer way, taking even more extraordinary risks. I mean, I really, you know, for those that listen that are, you know, part of the CIA, I really, really believe that's an organization that, one, has extraordinary people and some talent, but lost sight of what it was really, really the best in the world at, and that's human intelligence. And I've been plenty of conversations where people describe them as the best Air Force in the world. I don't know what that means. I just know that people have said that, you know, because of these mysterious, you know, things that happen around the world with some of these strikes. I think that's a cultural shift, and we've got to understand that if we want to have exquisite human intelligence that's not based in Paris, you know, that goes out there on the battlefield sometimes. Right. And I mean, not to say that there haven't been people that have done that, but you know, I mean, there's a reason why the special operations community, really, in a way, embraced that kind of intelligence themselves.
Right.
Because and then you wanted to bring in, you know, that agency closer because they had the authorities they had the money.
Yeah, you got the teams guys and the special operators are doing collection on the battlefield.
So, I mean, because I don't want to get into, you know, there's nothing we're talking about classified here, but I just think that we have to understand what are we really good at? What are our core capabilities? I believe, I'm sitting here today telling you this on, you know, in your podcast from the Spy Museum, I believe that that you could create an open source intelligence capability to compete against the U.S. intelligence community at far cheaper. Now, maybe we're able to do that because of the space programs that we've put into place and all these other things. But my shift, what I saw as a senior intelligence officer, and I went up to be the you know, the senior intelligence officer for the Department of Defense. In my days where you mentioned, like, you know, as a, you know, senior intelligence officer for 18th Airborne Corps. When I was the senior intelligence officer for 18th Airborne Corps prior to 9/11, most of the intelligence that I would present to my commander was you know, SIGINT, imagery, you know, some human, if it was, you know, some tactical, maybe some strategic stuff, you know, some analysis that was done at a very top secret level, almost 80%. So I'd go in there every day, I'd give them a briefing. You know, when we did operations, either exercises or real-world operations that we were still involved in the Balkans, you get your tactical intelligence reporting, you know, from your patrols and stuff like that. I would say about 80% was really in the world of INT, I-N-T. Today, it's the world of, I mean, that's flipped on its head.
Right.
It's like 90% now is in the world of open source, the open world of information. I mean, I was with a group the other day looking at some incredible open source capability that tells me everything I need to know as a military guy, tells me everything I need to know about planning, targeting, and operating from just that one capability. And it was all free except for the particular technology,
right.
but the data was free. And so you can maybe the intel community can go out and steal some more data and add it in there, and that gives you a refinement and enrichment of the intelligence. But really, the open world of information today, it has surpassed the intelligence community, and I think the intelligence community needs to find, you know, sort of rediscover its agility, its speed to action. And I think that they need to allow those down in the sort of the bowels of the organizations that exist to feel much more freedom to be able to really be honest.
Right.
Because Jim Clapper is a great guy, unbelievable servant of this country. But between sort of the old phrase in the military, it's between the bars and the stars. Well, you know, between those captain's bars and the stars above you, there's multiple layers. And believe me, the bureaucratic inertia in the United States intelligence community, the chokehold that exists, you know, is really something that is actually hurting us right now. It was just announced, I think, today that Mike Rogers, Admiral Mike Rogers, the commander of Cyber Command and the director of National Security Agency, just announced, I think he called it NSA 21, which is a means to reform, to reorganize the agency. And I would tell you that I'm a huge, huge fan of his. I think the world of him. I want nothing but that to be incredibly successful. But, you know, he exposed it in some presentation he gave the other day, and it's sort of out publicly now as announced. And there's already people. I've already gotten, you know, cards and letters from people telling me how, you know, this is going to be, you know, this part of the agency, that part of the agency, this part of the community. Hey, it's tough. If you don't do it, folks, you know, it's not that it's going to be perfect, and it's going to be hard. And he's not saying it's got to be done in 6 months.
Right.
I think his timeline is like 5 years. So, you know, give it a shot. Do something.
Right.
Be part of the solution. Be part of the solution. I felt this at DIA in a big way. And I'll tell you, I mean, and there's still people that are serving there that would get in the way of change because it wasn't good for them. It made them work harder. When I can tell you, the people down at the bowels are busting their humps.
Right.
People out in the commands, out in the field, in our embassies, in the combatant commands, and frankly, members of the science and tech community, National Media Exploitation Center, the analysts that are in various centers, whether it's in CIA or DIA, they're working their tails off. And all they want to do is they want to know that their leadership, so they heard from the director that the director wants this. Now, I know he didn't just wake up last night and think and dream it. You know, he's probably been talking quite a bit about it. Now he needs the help of the leadership, the bureaucrats in our system, to jump on board and move. Move and do it and get it done. Support it. support it, because you know what? It's one of these things where we don't have a choice but to change.
Right.
And because if we don't, those organizations that haven't changed, they go away. They go away. And the nations that are part of those, you know, that have those organizations as a part of them, those nations don't exist anymore. So anyway, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, well, so you continue to advocate and about the way that the intelligence community can be done better from the outside world. Again, you retired in 2014, and you're now the chairman and CEO of the Flynn Intel Group. I assume you named it after yourself. But what do you do? Like, what is the Flynn Intel Group doing?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We are involved in intelligence, security, cyber, and those sort of components. And what we have created is a very small, agile team to bring together partnerships and help those companies. So if it's a small company, particularly veteran-owned companies, in those commodity areas, intelligence, cyber, and security, frankly, for all what they call in the business world, all verticals, all market sectors, healthcare, transportation, you know, logistics, supply chain management, you know, and maybe some dabbling in government. But frankly, government is too hard to work with because it's just so incredibly bureaucratic. And there's a chokehold by many of the sort of the bigger guys that stunts those. So we're trying to partner. We're looking for we're leveraging the network that we have, which is international, commercial, business, and government to a degree, and trying to help companies who are good small companies to get better, mid-sized companies who are good and strong to even grow better, and partnering with them to basically have some fun. At the end of the day, the three words that we are about in Flynn Intelligence Group is defense, diplomacy, and development. And if we can combine those three things, and that's for countries who essentially are aligned in some way with our values here in this country, we'll help other countries. Certainly companies that are looking for help to be exposed to new ideas, new markets, we are being very innovative, very disruptive in some aspects. I personally see probably a dozen, 10 to a dozen companies a week, in terms of what they're doing and how they're trying to break in. And so with my experience in how to break into and how to talk to senior executives, senior leaders, C-suite level people, how to understand, you know, the complexity of what it is that they're trying to put together. And if I can do that in any way, if I can help in any way, we are. And that's you know, defense, diplomacy, and development are really the sort of the monikers that we like to tag to our shield, which is our logo.
Well, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, the former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency and many other things, as his bio showed us in the beginning, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Spy Museum.
Yeah, thanks, Vince. Thanks for having me. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to SpyCast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about SpyCast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @INTLSpycast. That's @INTLSpycast. Talk to you next week.